The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So welcome to those who've made it so far. This is the beginning of our Constitution Day observance, and we've got multiple events that are going to take place through the day, and it's all being podcast. And so the advantage to that is that people can catch it as they will on the WCL website. The disadvantage, of course, is that people begin to feel no obligation actually to be in the room because they can just go and click on the computer later. But for those of you who don't have class now or who are skipping class to be here, welcome, and we're looking forward to a number of classes showing up a bit later. So let me just start by introducing one of our distinguished guests, Peter Irons, who's a great constitutional historian and critic, and he will be leading us in discussion of two topics a bit later. One, the question of war powers, and the other, church-state relations and religion and politics in America today. But this session is about Mary Beth Tinker and her case, which is one of the great First Amendment decisions of the 20th century, Tinker versus Des Moines School District, decided by the Supreme Court in 1969. And this case is a central part of constitutional jurisprudence, and we're fortunate to have Mary Beth here to talk about what took place from her perspective. And Mary Beth, if you don't mind, I'd ask you to tell the story from your perspective, and I hope you don't mind, but when people get out of class, they're probably going to want to ask you again to go through the whole thing, but start from the beginning about what happened, and then we'll be able to have a discussion.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here on this occasion of celebrating the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. When I was 13 in eighth grade, we had a part to play in standing up for the Bill of Rights. The situation was that it was 1965, and there were a lot of issues in the country coming to the attention of our people. For one thing, the civil rights movement. The summer of 1964 was Freedom Summer, where a lot of students went south, and some adults too, from the north and from all over the country, to help African Americans register to vote in the south, because up until that time, as I'm sure all of you know, there were threats and people could not register to vote. They were under threat of death, and people were killed for trying to register to vote. And so throughout the South, there was a movement that summer to register people to vote, mostly in Mississippi, Freedom Summer concentrated on. And my parents went down as part of a group because my father was a minister, a Methodist minister. And so we learned about this issue, and we were also active in Des Moines, Iowa, where I lived at that time, in working for equal access to facilities. And I remember having pickets at the city hall in Des Moines around civil rights issues that would come up, and going to various churches around town to talk about these issues. And the other thing that was in the news a lot was the Vietnam War. At that time, about 1,000 U.S. soldiers had been killed, and the war was building up, and some students from our schools were being sent off more and more. I lived in a working-class neighborhood of Des Moines, and so kids were going into the military. And my father had been working with the Methodist Church as a minister, but then he eventually, so a couple of years earlier, went to work with the Quakers. And so we learned about peace from the point of view of the Quakers. As some of you may know, the Quakers are pacifists. So we were raised in that tradition of the Methodist Church and the Quakers, and we had a strong belief in peace and brotherhood and equality. And that's how we were raised. So that Christmas in November, right before Christmas, there was a march in Washington against the war. And a lot of people from Iowa went, including some people from my family. My brother and sister went, and my mother. And when they came back on the bus, the Iowa group was talking about things that they could do to speak up about the war and to advocate for peace in Vietnam and to support a Christmas truce that Robert Kennedy was calling for. And especially he was asking that the truce be extended longer than it was planned for so that there would be time to have peace negotiations. So they wanted to find a way to speak up about this issue and to talk about peace at Christmas time. And that's what they came back from the March on Washington talking about. And I was involved with a youth group then. It was a church youth group. And the kids in the church youth group, we were talking about this issue. And they knew about the plan. And so we all decided that we would wear black armbands on December 16th to mourn the dead in Vietnam on both sides, whether it was the Vietnamese or the U.S. soldiers, and also to call for the extension of the Christmas truce that Robert Kennedy was calling for. So some of the older kids were at Roosevelt High School. I was at Harding Junior High School. But the older kids were in high school, and they, one of them wrote an article for his school newspaper, which the principal reviewed, because he reviewed, I think, all of the articles for the school newspaper. And so that's how the principals found out about the plan. Not that we were particularly trying to keep it from them, but they did find out about it. And they had a hasty meeting of all the principals and ruled that students would not be allowed to wear black armbands to school because they felt it was too controversial and it was potentially disruptive of the school, the schools in Des Moines. This case went to the district court and the appeals court, and we lost in both levels. At one level, it was tied, but essentially we lost the students, we lost the case. The American Civil Liberties Union approached our parents and offered to take the case because we had no money. We couldn't pursue it. My parents, you know, we had a large family, and there was no possibility of us pursuing it, so the American Civil Liberties Union offered to take the case. And it went through the courts, and we lost until it got to the Supreme Court in November of 1968. And it was heard in court, and we won the case in February of 1969. There were only five students that were suspended from school, and one of the judges in the Supreme Court at that time, the justices, was Thurgood Marshall. Stamp pin I'm wearing. I'm proud to be wearing it. One of my heroes. And he asked the lawyer for the school board, "Are you telling me that you thought an action by five students could disrupt a school system of, I think it was 16,000 students?" But apparently the school board did think that because they had ruled that we would not be allowed to wear the armbands. In the end, the Supreme Court decided that the actions that we took, our right to wear the armbands was more important than the possibility of disrupting the school or the actual disruption that occurred, which was did not exist. We didn't disrupt the school at all. So the Supreme Court ruled that students have a right to have free speech rights in the public schools unless it is substantially disruptive. As a result of the case, my family was harassed and attacked, but also supported by our community. We got a lot of support from the community in Des Moines because a lot of people there were raised with the same values as we were, to believe in peace and fairness. And so we got a lot of support from families and friends. My friends and their families were very supportive. But we also got some harassment. There was an incident where someone called my house on Christmas Eve and threatened to blow up our house. Also, we went back to school after Christmas in January. We were out of school about 1 week with the suspension. And when we went back to school in January, we wore black clothes for the whole rest of the year. And some people called our house, and as I was leaving for school with my black clothes on, someone called me, and they asked for Mary Beth, and I got on the phone, and she said, "I'm going to kill you." And so we also got some postcards. At that time, it wasn't terrorists that the government was frantic about. It was communists. And so I was raised in a climate where in about, you know, fifth grade, fourth grade, sixth grade, we would have air raid drills. We were told that the communists were going to possibly be dropping a nuclear bomb on us at any time, and we needed to be prepared. So at a certain time of day, we would be told to all get under our desks in case there was a nuclear bomb dropped on us. So we would, you know, scramble around, crawl under our desk, and even at that age, we could see that this was kind of crazy, but that was the climate back then. Now it's terrorists. Anyway, most of the students in our school were supportive of what I was doing, and when I went to my classroom that day as I was wearing the armband, I knew I was breaking a rule. And what I tell kids when I go out and talk to kids in the high schools is that when there's a rule that's made that you don't agree with, that you feel is wrong, or that you feel there's a higher issue at stake, then you have a moral dilemma. Do you follow that rule, or do you break it and stand up and try to change it? And so that's a decision that all of us will likely be faced with at some point in our lives, at least once. And that was the day that I faced it. And so I decided to go ahead and wear the armband anyway, because I believed in peace, and I believed that wearing the armband was my right, and that I wasn't going to do anything wrong that would disrupt the school. But when I got to my math class, the math teacher had spent the whole day before then telling us about how we were going to be put out of school if we wore armbands, and that he didn't think it was right to wear armbands, et cetera, et cetera. So he was standing at the door of the schoolroom when I got there and told me to go to the office to take off the armband. Ironically, some years ago, there was an anniversary of the armband incidents a few years ago in the Des Moines schools. At that time, the three of us that went to the Supreme Court were invited back to the Des Moines School District to speak at the schools as, quote, visiting scholars. When I was in eighth grade, and this is what I tell the kids when I speak to them, I was just a kid in trouble, and I didn't really have any idea of the significance of the case. Some years later, we're invited back as visiting scholars. So you never know how things are going to turn out, and I encourage kids to talk and speak up, and I encourage all of you to do the same, to speak up and think about what you think is right, and to make your decision based on that, not what's popular, because there are a lot of things in history that have been reversed, and there have been a lot of apologies made. I just saw a couple years ago where the Southern Baptist Church has now finally apologized for their support for slavery. The Pope apologized a while back for the Catholic Church not being more supportive during the Holocaust of the Jews. So the future can come out in various ways, and this is what my message to kids is, that stand up for what you believe in and for what you believe is right, because things can change. History can vindicate those that do take a stand, even though it may not be popular at the time. And I think that's what happened in our case. And then I tie up what happened to us to current affairs and to the current day. Many of the same issues, and I just came from a high school, Cordova High School in Washington, where I spoke with a group of high school kids and talked about the issues that were facing us back then in the 1965 time period, whether it was poverty, jobs, equality, racism, peace. And the kids, you know, they felt that these are the same issues that are facing us today. And I agree. There are many things about what we did to take a stand that I think high school kids can relate to today, that are grappling with how they are going to react to the situation they find themselves in today in our country. And so I try to give kids the motivation and the inspiration to get involved and stand up for what they believe in, and to have hope and the spirit to shake things up and to change what they think needs changing. So that's been my experience. I don't know.
Mary Beth, thanks. Why don't we open it up to discussion? And Peter, I don't know whether you have any questions for Mary Beth from an historian's perspective that you might want to ask her to kick off our discussion here.
Well, actually, I had not anticipated opening my mouth for another hour or so, but I do want to say a couple of things. First of all, I first met Mary Beth, I think it was 1987, and in St. Louis, outside of St. Louis, where you lived at the time. And I was then writing a book called The Courage of Their Convictions, and actually Mary Beth has a copy right there next to her. And the point of this book was to go around the country and talk to people who had started cases that wound up in the Supreme Court. It's called 16 Americans Who Fought Their Way to the Supreme Court. And it was quite an eye-opening experience for me, meeting people, many of whom had started cases that are now in the con law case books, famous cases, but they're very, very ordinary people. And I think one of the points of Mary Beth's experience is that I'm sure you didn't have the slightest idea when you first put on your armband that you would wind up in the Supreme Court of the United States and a landmark decision would come out of that case. But I think that's one of the points, that it's only when ordinary people take extraordinary stands on principle that the law moves ahead. Of course, it doesn't always move in the right direction, and there's a lot of retrogression in the law, particularly in the last few years. But without people like Mary Beth, I don't think that we would have the kind of rights that we now take for granted. And it really is an act of courage. In the interview I did for The Courage of Their Convictions, Mary Beth, and she didn't tell you a lot of the things that happened, and maybe she could say a bit more about them, but I remember one of them was that not only the woman who called up and threatened to kill her, but a radio talk show host said that if anybody took a shotgun after the Tinkers, he would defend them. And at one point, they even threatened your little sister, who was like 6 years old at the time. So I think that we have to understand that our rights are constantly under attack by those, and today is a very good parallel, those who speak out against war, against injustice, against poverty, are very often subjected to reprisals, sanctions, unjust laws. The last thing I want to say here is that there's a very good parallel between Mary Beth's case and another case that began back in 1935, 30 years before hers, of another young girl who was only 12 at the time, Lillian Gobitis, lived in a very small town in Pennsylvania, Minersville, Pennsylvania. She was a Jehovah's Witness. And as an act of solidarity with witnesses in Germany who were being persecuted by the Nazis, thrown into prison, she decided to stop saluting the American flag. And she was expelled from school. She wasn't just suspended for 5 days. She was expelled from public school. In fact, she never went back because the school board passed a rule, just like yours, that said refusing to salute the flag is an act of insubordination. And it went up to the Supreme Court. And unlike the court in your case, where Justice Fortas wrote a decision that was, I think, a classic in First Amendment law, Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote an opinion that was one of the worst ever in this field, in which he basically said that national security, he said, depends on national unity, and that the expression, he said, we can't make exceptions for dissidents, particularly during time of national crisis. And I think we're in another period like that. The aftermath of that case was that 3 years later, the Supreme Court in 1943 overturned the Gobitis decision. And I'm sure those of you in constitutional law have read the opinion of Justice Robert Jackson in West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, which I think is probably one of the two most important decisions involving individual rights the Supreme Court has ever issued. I'll talk later during my segment about the other case. But in West Virginia versus Barnett, Justice Jackson said, if there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what is orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force anyone to profess their belief therein. And I think that really, in a very short capsule, is what the First Amendment is all about.
Thank you, Peter. The occasion for us gathering today is the first mandatory annual observance of Constitution Day. And the history is interesting because Constitution Day has traditionally been a kind of half-hearted holiday thrown together by the American Bar Association, where a lawyer gets up and gives a kind of sterile lecture about what happened in Philadelphia, and then a group of students who are forced to be in the room clap and everyone leaves and it's over. And it's because of a graduate of our law school, Senator Robert Byrd, that now there's a policy and a requirement that every educational institution in the country, whether public or private, that receives federal funds, has to observe Constitution Day. And so we're trying to get a new holiday tradition started here, and our theory is to celebrate Constitution Day from the ground up, that is, from the perspective of people who make the Constitution meaningful through exercise of their rights. Mary Beth is an exemplary figure here. She represents someone who is in deep, profound touch with her surroundings and her political environment, and she has the great virtue of not being afraid. And so she's not afraid to speak her mind. She's not afraid to challenge authority. I asked her to write in a foreword to the new edition of my book, We the Students, and in her foreword, she wrote about the emperor who has no clothes and how it's a kid who declares the obvious truth that no one else is willing to speak. It's a kid who says, ultimately, the emperor has no clothes. And what's fascinating to me about Mary Beth is that when she meets people, they expect her to be a kind of timepiece. That is, she's just going to talk about her case and what happened to her, and it's actually hard to get her to talk about her case and what happened to her. She wants to talk about what's going on in the lives of young people today. And she has this passionate connection to young people and the struggles that they go through, both as individual kids and also as a community. But I like the idea of celebrating the Constitution with someone for whom the Constitution is just the beginning of their public engagement. The Constitution is just a piece of parchment if we revere it and we worship it, but we don't make it meaningful in terms of how we relate to each other every day in our institutions. So when Mary Beth goes out to high schools or junior high schools, the principals and teachers can get nervous sometimes because she's not just talking about what happened in the middle of the last century, she's talking about what's going on right now in terms of sex education in the schools, in terms of the rights of kids to challenge military recruiters on campus today, in terms of the privacy interests of kids in their lockers and so on. It's a living constitution, not because the paper lives, but because the people who live by it are willing to hold government to the principles embodied in it. So I'm very honored that Mary Beth chose to be with us on our first annual observance of the Constitution Day. And why don't we open it up now to questions? Yes. Jeffrey, please.
Here, and I'm not sure how I feel that a federally mandated
Well, there's no punishment for not participating.
I'm so glad to be here to talk about these issues because it's very relevant to high school kids and what is going on today, just as you said, Jeff. The climate is different in some ways. It's worse now. There is a kind of a restrictive atmosphere there as far as children. Children. I've always been a child advocate, actually. I'm a pediatric nurse and I'm a family nurse practitioner. I work mostly with children, and so I've become concerned about the rights of children, not just their right to free speech, but their right to health care and housing and good schools and all of these things. And there's an atmosphere right now in the country, and Professor Raskin, along with Miriam Aranjani, has also written a fabulous new book on youth justice and how young people are increasingly being tried as adults and put into prison and being denied education and just being run through the criminal justice system. And I think that kind of atmosphere goes together with the atmosphere we have of scapegoating children for the problems of our society and withholding services from our children. So I think you're right. If it happened today, that we would be, you know, accused of not being in our place, our parents would be attacked for not controlling their children, this kind of thing, which did happen back then too. Back then, it was, as I said, it was the communists that were considered the big threat. And so what happened, my parents received big placards with hammer and sickle on it saying hate, our postcards with John Kennedy's stamp. There's a stamp then of John Kennedy, and then my father's address would be on it, and there'd be arrow pointing to both of them saying traitors with a little hammer and sickle in the corner. And we were accused of being communists. But that's why I'm so honored to be here and be part of this and to be with Professor Raskin and Peter Irons, who is one of my heroes for really making the Constitution accessible to people, because not only is it ordinary people that are involved with these cases, but it is ordinary people that need to know about these cases. And the writings in books like The Courage of Their Convictions, you can read about cases like one in St. Louis that outlawed discrimination in housing, where I'm from, St. Louis. Cases where a teacher was pregnant and was going to be kept from teaching. Just, you know, cases that, and they're written in interesting ways so the ordinary people can have access to them. And the Marshall Brennan program that goes out into the public schools and teaches people about these programs. But it helps to empower kids and empower their families to counteract that kind of restrictive climate that we have that scapegoats kids and withholds services that are needed by them today.
let's see. The Supreme Court itself has taken some large bites out of the Tinker principle. Tinker is one of the great First Amendment decisions of all time. And actually, it's our conviction in the Marshall Brennan Project that you can really teach a great course on the Constitution through the prism of public schools, generally. And Tinker is the high watermark of Supreme Court defense of free speech rights. But since then, the Supreme Court has been steadily eroding the Tinker principle. In 1986, in Bethel versus Fraser, the Supreme Court upheld discipline against a kid who made a kind of racy nominating address for his best friend for student council. There was no actual profanity or indecent language in it, but it was all based on a protracted sophomoric sexual metaphor. But, you know, it was no big deal, you would think, under Tinker. It didn't fundamentally disrupt the educational process. But the court said, okay, it's all right to discipline kids for indecent language. Now, we probably could have lived with that, but then 2 years later, in 1988 in Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier, the Supreme Court then upheld a principle's unilateral and somewhat impulsive censorship of two articles in a student newspaper, a school-sponsored student newspaper. And one article was about teen pregnancy and about how kids who were pregnant at school dealt with it and the problems and how to avoid it and how it happened. Well, I guess it's obvious how it happened, but why they got themselves into that situation. And the other article was about the impact of divorce on kids in public schools. Well, the Supreme Court, in a split decision with our namesakes, Marshall and Brennan, dissenting, but the majority said in the Hazelwood case that that the material was unsuitable for an immature audience, and that if the school sponsors a publication like a newspaper or yearbook or an assembly or what have you, the Tinker test doesn't apply. That is, the test is not one of a presumptive free speech right bounded only by disruption of the educational process. The test is simply whether there's some reasonable pedagogical objective in censoring the speech. So the Supreme Court itself has sadly narrowed the triumph of the Tinker decision. But Tinker still operates, at least theoretically, outside of school-sponsored activities and outside of indecent speech. The problem, Jeff, as you suggest, is that very few cases go up to the Supreme Court. Very few cases even go to federal district court or a state superior court. So where does the Constitution get defined? It gets defined in the classroom. It gets defined in the hallway. It gets defined in the principal's office. And that's the importance of what all of the Marshall Brennan Fellows are doing, not just here at AU and Howard, but at Rutgers and in Arizona State and Oregon and now the University of Pennsylvania. The Marshall Brennan Fellows are going out and introducing constitutional values into the public schools to say, here's what the Supreme Court has said. Here are the competing values and interests that are at stake, and let's talk about it before there's a crisis, before there's a problem. Or if there is a problem or there's a crisis, people have some context within which to understand the conflicts that arise. Now, there, some courts have been giving much more leeway to schools to censor, but other judges continue to stand proudly by the Tinker principle, and you almost have to go judge by judge to see which way they're going to go. But, you know, our resolve is that a constitutionally literate population is one that's going to be in a better position to defend its rights against the ever-encroaching whims of government, as, you know, Peter Irons has taught us. Liberty is never safe. So, more questions for Mary Beth about her case? More discussion, right? Sir?
It was in December of 1965 that we wore the armbands. The case was heard in the Supreme Court in November of 68. So it was 3 years to wind its way to the Supreme Court. And then in February of 69, the case was decided. So it was about 3 years, which to me seemed like an enormous amount of time back then, especially being a teenager. So I got a little cynical about the court system and that these things take forever and they're not going to make that much difference and et cetera, et cetera. But in the long run, you know, I see now that's how it is, that these cases are decided sometimes quickly and sometimes it takes a little more time. But the second part of your question was what again? Oh, at the time of the decision, in the school? Yeah, that was interesting because, especially from the point of view of a teenager and child development, sort of, you know, as a nurse working with kids a lot, I can see this now. The way that I reacted made a lot of sense, but because I had just moved to a new school that November, it was the middle of 11th grade, and I was, you know, meeting new friends and trying to adapt to a whole new city and a whole new school. So my mind was on other things, personal things, and I was very, very shy then too. And so when we won the case, suddenly these national news, you know, were swooping down on us, and Time Magazine, Newsweek, they were coming to my chemistry class and snapping photos outside of school, and, you know, and we had just gotten to this new school. I barely knew anyone. I think I was eating my lunch in the bathroom, you know, it was really pathetic. But so just from a personal point of view, it was really hard to adjust to it. And like Jamie said, I don't get scared. You know, I'm happy to speak up about my position, my beliefs all the time, but it's not true. I do get scared. You know, I'm like anyone else. And as a kid, it was intimidating. And, you know, one of my memories of going to the appeals court in St. Louis, it was in 1966, I think, I was about 14 years old. My main concern was that I had a run in my stocking, you know, and I wanted to look nice. You know, I'm going to court. This is a big deal, you know. So, I mean, I had the usual reactions of kids my age, you know, went through those things. But the kids in the school were very supportive. And as I said, it gave me a new respect for how crazy some people are, and as I've learned more and more about what people have gone through in history to stand up for what they believe in, what we went through was nothing, but I have come to really appreciate and see how some people are just really completely crazy. And it did make me a little bit cautious about Christianity also, I'll have to say, through my life, because my father was a preacher, and we were doing this out of a belief in peace and brotherhood, and that's really where all of our actions came from as far as politics, and they still do today. My political views and my political action come from a deep sense of spirituality, but the attacks that we encountered from Christians who misunderstood our actions and called us communists, and some people, you know, who threatened us, really made me realize that there are people out there that misunderstand and that, you know, interpret their views a lot differently than you may. So, you know, it caused me to be cautious in life when I pick up the phone and someone asks for me. I want to know who's calling. I ask who it is and, you know, things like that. But I did start to think that there are a lot of people out there that you have to be cautious about.
Mary Beth, in law school, we study these cases, and people's names, like your name, are just things that you got to memorize for a test, really. You know, like nobody knows much about Linda Brown or Miranda or Tinker, or, you know, we use these as placeholders for constitutional concept. But what has it meant to you to be the name plaintiff? In a case that goes to the Supreme Court that became a constitutional landmark, and how has it affected your life? How has it changed the course of your career and the decisions you've made?
It has changed my life, and that's what I was telling the high school kids that I was speaking to this morning over at Cordova. Because
Cordoza,
I'm sorry. When you commit yourself and become part of a movement, which is a worldwide movement, to change the world and to shake things up and to stand up for what you believe is right, and God knows we have plenty of things that need changing. We reviewed some of those this morning. The kids had mostly the ideas. It makes your life so interesting. Not only do you change the world, you help to change the world, but you help to change your life. And you will meet the most interesting people. Like sitting here today, I'm on a panel with Jamie Raskin and Peter Irons. I'm talking to all of you. And I tell the kids, it's a lot more fun because you can say what you think in life. And once you start doing that, you know, you really have a lot more interesting life. It becomes a lot more fun. And, you know, I try to talk about it with the kids in a way that's upbeat, because there's so many there are so many demoralized people now, and I'm sure some of us have had all those feelings too. Because you look at all the problems of the world, and I want to give these kids some inspiration and some feeling that it's good to get involved with these things, and it's going to make you feel good. And it really has had that effect on me. I've had a wonderful, rich life of fighting for what I believe is right, and joining up with people all over the world to make these changes. So it's been a really positive thing. And as I said, not only do I realized at some point how significant the case was. I mean, when people like Peter Iron start calling me up to write books, you know, and things like that, it has an impact. But I also started to realize that kids need a lot of other kinds of rights besides the freedom to speak up about controversial things. They need a right to decent school. You know, they need schools. They need to get their shots for school. They need to have safe homes to live in. Most injuries to children occur in their own home, often at the hands of their own parents who are stressed out over all kinds of things. And so as I worked with children more and more and went into pediatrics and became a nurse, I really got a much bigger appreciation of the real problems that kids are facing and the kinds of things that we need to fight for kids to have, like a decent education. I learned about some of the cases over the years, like the Rodriguez case. You know, he tried to stand up for the rights of children to have equal education. And I learned about people like Jonathan Cozzal, and who advocates for children in the public schools. And so it's been a wonderful, rich life, and I encourage all kids and all people to get involved with standing up for what you believe in and trying to take the world to a better place.
As you were saying, Mary Beth, we've at the school this morning, we saw a lot of kids who felt kind of despondent about the state of the world with the war in Iraq and the hurricane and the reaction to the hurricane and so on. You clearly have maintained your boundless optimism. But do you feel that the movements that you were part of in the 60s succeeded, like the peace movement and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement? Are the kids today, the young people today, law students, college students, high school students, are they going to have to fight the same battles?
That's interesting. I think my view of it has always been that we didn't make more gains in the areas of equality, civil rights, peace, justice, economic justice, all of those things that I've spent my life working on, because of the opposition that we encountered largely. It was enormously well-funded, covert, much of it. As I find out more and more about programs like COINTELPRO, that was a secret program of the government to go in and spy on and destroy peace groups and black groups that were working for the rights of black people, etc. I feel that it wasn't so much, it wasn't really a surprise that we didn't gain more than we did when you look at what we were up against. And I mean, then you had the assassinations of some of the strongest leaders that we had, whether it's Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, the Kennedys. You know, these were really icons and people that we had hope in. Robert Kennedy, when he was killed, it was a major blow, because there was a big hope that he was going to be in a position of power and be able to turn things around. So I think a lot of it I can explain it through that. But no, I think these problems go on forever. When you look at this book, and you're going to hear more about it later, War Powers, this goes back to when the country was founded. We've been fighting these same fights, and I think we'll keep going on. And as my mother, she's always quoting this person in Mississippi, one of the black people that was real involved with fighting for voting rights there, who's always said, we just have to keep on keeping on. And that's kind of been our mantra in our family, and I do believe that. We just have to keep at it and keep trying to make things better and standing up for changing these issues.
Yep.
I think
Tell him about your son.
Jamie is trying to tell me I should tell about my son when he was in high school. He's 25 now. But he had, for one thing, he has a T-shirt that has a nurse on it with a little nurse's cap who's wearing almost nothing. You know, she's got this little nice buxomy look, you know, and spike heels and everything, you know, and something like, you can heal me, baby, or something like that, you know. So I said, you're taking that shirt off. You are not going to school with that shirt on. Oh, so he said, you're a hypocrite. You are such a hypocrite. I can't believe you. I don't care what you are. I don't care. You're not going out of the door with that shirt on. So, yeah, I don't know if that was hypocritical or not, but, as far as limitations, you know, the more I think, I used to think, yeah, we're in a battle against the Nazis, the Klan, you know, et cetera, and we need to restrict them as much as possible. And, you know, ironically, even though I went through this whole experience with my case, I felt like, you know, just from a gut level, because of knowing what they had done and talking to people, the terror, the horror that had been spread through the world, that it's a war and we have to fight them with whatever we can. But now I've changed, I've matured. You know, I feel that the best way is not to drive those groups underground, but it's to, you know, we all have to have our rights and freedom of speech, and that's really the best way, is to, you know, carry on the dialogue above ground and have everyone out there. But are there restrictions? As far as school kids, you know, I've been a school nurse. I've worked with principals and teachers, and, you know, should kids be able to wear little tiny halter tops and, you know, et cetera, which they want to restrict in schools sometimes? I think there's probably some reasonable dress code limitations. I've been really happy to see how my case has been used to talk in schools about sex education, and also to have school clinics in some of the high schools. And like in Boston, I was speaking in Boston some years ago, and schools there had used the Tinker case to get condoms into the high schools, because I'm in public health also. I have a master's degree in public health, and I know that condoms are the number one recommendation for preventing teenagers from getting AIDS. That's the CDC's number one recommendation. So anything that gets condoms into the hands of teenagers, I'm in favor of it. And I heard that my case had been used to defend the rights of students to hear about sex education, and also to have access to safe sex, you know, condoms, et cetera. So I'm glad to see all those things. But, I think I'm like anyone. I don't think there's any black and white answers to these issues. Someone called me up from Des Moines, Iowa a few years ago and said, well, this kid wants to wear a swastika to school, and, you know, what do you think about that? And, you know, I have to grapple with these things just like everybody else does when they come up. I don't think there are any easy answers to these things. One time, recently in St. Louis, I was going to speak at a high school, and I lived there in a neighborhood. It's very urban, it's very mixed racially. The graduation rate at this high school at that time was 16%. And I was involved with some public health programs out in the schools, and I was going to speak at one of the schools about the Tinker armband case. And the principal canceled me coming, saying that there had been too much gang activity in that school, and the kids were wearing, you know, their colors, gang colors, et cetera. So they didn't want me to come because they didn't want the kids to know about their right to wear this color or that color, you know. So, you know, these things are not set down, and they change.
Well, you know, it's funny. In the Marshall Brennan Project, when we first began it 6 years ago, we encountered much of the same reaction. Some of the principals said, wait a second, you want to send law students into public high schools to teach them about their rights? You know, I don't think so. But now the schools are eager to get us in there. Why? Because when you start to teach people about their rights, they understand that rights are always joined with responsibilities. Because if I have a right, it only makes sense if you respect it. And so part of what's built into my right is my obligation to respect your corresponding right. Mm-hmm. And so rights and responsibilities are inextricably bound up together. And I think that if we treat kids like rational beings who can understand that, then they mature through the process. And we, I'm proud to say, and my fingers are crossed, but we've never had a case of a student who has gone on to sue his or her school just because they've got a constitutional education. just because they've gotten a constitutional education through the Marshall Brennan Project. However, we have had Marshall Brennan fellows who have resolved serious problems at schools. We were at a school last year where there was one of the girls, one of the high school students who was a girl, was on the baseball team. It was the boys' baseball team. And then a new baseball coach came in and just summarily kicked her out of the team. And the Marshall Brennan fellows very quickly did the research on Title IX and found that because this was a non-contact sport and there was no girls' baseball team, they had to allow her on it if she could make the team on the merits, which she did. Well, all over the country there are schools that are just routinely violating kids' rights. But what we're doing is we're putting law students kind of into the front lines, and they're able to say, wait a second, there's a legal structure here to these problems, and we can help to figure it out.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful program, and I have been so happy to be part of it for the last few years, because also I have learned over my years of working as a nurse that one of the healthiest things that kids can do for their overall health is graduate from high school. If they graduate from high school, they are going to be they're going to be much healthier in the long run. So I want to keep kids in school. And programs like this, or talks like this, what we did this morning, I mean, we were playing music, we're talking about the hurricane, we're talking about poverty, you know, the kids were yelling out things they thought. I mean, that keeps kids interested in school, and it makes them want to stay in school. And, you know, I have this, I show them little news articles, like, you know, kids, you got to keep up with what's going on. And I show them little things that are going on, like this one here from the LA Times, Los Angeles Times, showing that a Harvard University study shows that 39% of Latinos and 47% of African American students in LA graduated from high school in the LA schools. That's 39% Latinos and 47% African Americans graduated high school in the LA city schools. Now that is pathetic. So programs like this, if we can reach out to kids, make school more interesting, you know, that's what it's all about. And I think these programs do help to do that.
All right. Well, if there are no further questions, Mary Beth, thank you so much for being with us. I know you're going
to
be around
Glad
today.
To be here.
And she's willing to talk to people. We'll take a quick break. I think we have some pizza here if anybody wants to get some. And then we're going to start with our next panel about war powers under the Constitution today with Peter Irons. Thank you all for coming.